Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of ADHD in Isolation. I thought it would be appropriate for this historic moment to welcome my father as the first guest on the show, partly because he's got a lot of relevant experience in the field of ADHD, and he's worked in criminal justice, and he's worked in schools and all over the place, but also because he's a father of someone with ADHD, and I thought that he could talk authoritatively on both topics. So welcome, Dad.
Hello.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, from perspective of a parent, what how you kind of came to terms with ADHD, how you first found out about ADHD, because I don't think it was particularly well known when I was in school.
I think it had been about 1999, and so you would be 9 years old at the time. And I was working in a boarding school where we had about 85, 90 youngsters. And there was one particular youngster who got me thinking a lot about additional support needs and about eventually led me down the path of looking at some Asperger syndrome or the autism spectrum. And while I was doing that, inevitably, I came across the idea of other neurodevelopmental disorders and ADHD in particular. I'm quite shocked to find out that the prevalence rates at the time were thought to be between 3% and 7%, which is a lot of young people. But in my mind, I thought working in an independent school, a private school, a fee-paying school, that it wouldn't really have any relevance to the majority of the kids that we had. And then a colleague of mine went on exchange to Australia, and he came back talking about ADHD out there and the fact that he had a youngster who had to take medication at break times and so on. And it started me thinking quite a bit. And I was extremely skeptical. First, you know, from the point of view of thinking, well, it's probably just something that's been made up by a Californian psychiatrist to explain why American families can't bring up children anymore. And it was that level of cynicism. But then, first of all, I started looking around at the kids that we were supervising in the boarding house. And what became very clear early on was around about a quarter to a third had some form of difficulty. And with my lack of expertise over many, many years, I was missing young people with specific learning difficulties, such as dyslexia, but also ADHD, autism spectrum. And when we did an audit of those 85 to 90 children, we reckoned there were 26, 27 who were affected in some way, some quite severely, some less so, but all displayed certain difficulties in terms of their ability to socialize, in terms of their learning, their relationships, and so on. And then we also started to think about our own family and some of the difficulties we were having with you and the difficulties.
Which were?
Well, let's turn that around, because that, the difficulties that you yourself were having, both at school and at home, and which I'm happy to describe very shortly. But of course, we as parents, and in an age, in an era when neurodevelopmental disorders were not universally recognized and we weren't sensitized to them, the natural thing to do is to blame yourself as a parent. And the natural thing for other family members to do is to blame you as parents. So alongside everything that's happening with your own children, there is this around the family, you have issues to do with guilt, to do with attribution, blame, responsibility. But I suppose fundamental to our thinking at the time was that the normal parenting techniques weren't working. And they were working with their other two children, but they weren't working with you. So, in fact, I don't recall with the other two having any major upsets or arguments, anything of any significance at all, whereas with you, it was on a daily basis and several times a day.
Yeah, so, just to cut in, I remember growing up and thinking just my siblings just seemed almost alien-like. They were so placid and measured and just seemed to be so in control of their emotions and able to play with other kids without problems. And it was very confusing because, as you said, I mean, you're in the same family, right? You're from the same gene pool. And it was kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and it throws up some interesting points about family dynamics, that you can have exactly the same family setup, But each member of that family has a completely different experience. And for children growing up, that means although the parents are effectively the same parents, you get different types of parenting according to the child that you have. And with the child with ADHD, you can end up feeling that you're very ineffective as a parent. But the experiences for that child can be very, very different compared to their siblings. So I'm sure that your siblings felt that family life was quite stable and they were quite happy because in many respects they were able to negotiate their childhood development without any major upsets, whereas you came across as quite unhappy, quite depressed at times, angry a lot of the time, and it was a sort of misdirected anger. It wasn't anger at anything in particular, and I think that made it all the more confusing for you. So it came to the point when I was sitting doing my work, thinking about the children that I was supposed to be supporting as a professional, and I suddenly realized, so hang on a moment, this applies within the family as well. And it really came across when you stood in my study and said that you didn't really like yourself. And I remember saying to a colleague, I'm not sure that I like my own son very much, which is a very hard thing for a parent to say. But it was, that was before a period of enlightenment when we realized that actually we needed to think about things in a very, very different way. And we took the easy option and we went private and we got some sort of assessment from someone who I think wasn't probably an expert, but we just took along the assessment tools and she did what she had to do and said probably ADHD or ADD, as it was referred to in those inattentive ADHD. And then you were seen by a child psychiatrist who said the same thing, but he also picked up on some other points about your motor movements and motor difficulties at the time. And I think he also looked at family dynamics and said, you know, suggested that I was working too hard and wasn't spending enough time with you. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But he was quite enlightened in understanding the impact of ADHD on the whole family.
Yeah, I was just thinking there about, because I was your first child. And we've actually never really talked about this, so this is kind of interesting. This doesn't feel very contrived. So I was your first child, and that just got me thinking about that. Obviously, without the kind of lens of kind of neurodevelopmental disorders to look through, it doesn't surprise me that you didn't particularly like me. And it does make me think. Because you know, like I used to come back and just ruin my siblings' playtime, right, and stuff for no reason, and I was probably came across as quite bitter and quite unpleasant. And I suppose as in the early years, you've not really got empathy to fall back on. You've not really developed empathy. So I suppose you could come across as quite a poisonous kid in a sense. You've not got that same level of depth of understanding about how you're quite self-centered, right, as a kid.
And so I think a lot of kids are. And we take this idea of empathy is actually very complex because it's still not fully understood. And I would say, I think there may be gender differences. I think that girls, for example, may develop empathy to a higher level in a more sophisticated way than boys do. And that may partly be evolutionary in that girls in extended families in the past were taking on child caring responsibilities at a very early age. And so maybe there's something in terms of evolution
or maybe a different kind of empathy, right? Maybe it doesn't all go along the same. Same with autism, right? It's with autism, it's not a question necessarily of an absence of empathy. It's a kind of empathy in a different form, right?
Yeah. So I describe that as, you know, when it's my birthday, my wife buys me a present because she loves me. When it's her birthday, I buy her a present because it's her birthday. It's and that's what you're supposed to do. That's true. But I think going back to the whole idea of the family, what you said you were the eldest, and I was one of three. I was the eldest of three. And when I had difficulties, people said, well, it's because he's the oldest in the family. You know, he doesn't have anyone to look up to or follow. When my youngest sister had difficulties, it was because she was the youngest in the family. When my middle sister had difficulties, it was because she was neither the oldest nor the youngest and therefore had an identity problem. So all this sort of woolly thinking, false causation and false attribution. I think you've got to be very, very careful of that. And it goes that particularly applies to families where they're judged by others, whether it's social care professionals or teachers or other family members, is that as a parent struggling with a child, someone will look at you and what you do and say it's because you wear funny coloured waistcoats, or you because you're not at home enough, or because there's been a divorce in the family, or you've got a bit of a temper, or because you use drugs, and so on. And actually, that's very simplistic thinking, because what we do know about ADHD is that there is a strong tendency to run in families. It's very heritable, not as heritable as autism, but it's up there 75-80% in terms of heritability to explain the variance in the population. So there's a very, very strong possibility if a child has ADHD that someone else in one of the parents has it, or at least a close relative. And there can be a tendency to blame, attach responsibility to the parent rather than understanding that there may be a genetic link. And that's really important when you're making quite complex judgments about the capacity of a family to bring up a child in those more extreme circumstances.
What about, let's talk pre-diagnosis. What was going on pre-diagnosis? Because I think I was diagnosed about 8 or 9 years old.
It depends how far back you want to go. Your circumstances are slightly unusual in that you were born out in Spain, and we were living in a mountain village just about 4,000 feet with a small elderly population, a very idyllic setting. And we brought you back to the village. You were the first child that had been born in the village for some like 25 years, and so the villagers were absolutely delighted to see you. We obviously, you were a first child, so we didn't have anything to compare your development against. And the first thing that was difficult for you, you had colic, so you would barely sleep for more than 45 minutes, an hour at a time, which was incredibly draining on us. But it also, that's the first time as parents you think we're doing something wrong. We're not feeding you enough, we're feeding you too much, something wrong in the environment, whatever. And one of the things I remember very early on is that in order to get you to sleep, rather than rocking you gently, we had to rock you violently, almost throw you around in our arms. And that seemed to soothe you. And because that was very tiring, what we did in our house, we had chestnut beams along the ceiling, and we set up your carry cot on like a swing, so tied to the rope beams, and we used to whack you backwards and forwards, and that seemed to calm you down. It was really, really strange. I didn't think too much about it. But when we came back to Britain, we were working up in a school in Scotland, and when it got to the time where you were going to playgroup, for example, I wasn't involved. It was your mother who took you. But the next noticeable thing was that you didn't join in. You just stood and watched. And she would leave you at the beginning, standing and watching, and she would return however long later, and you would still be, well, everyone else was gathered together on the floor singing nursery rhymes or whatever they were doing, you were just standing watching. And there was a point where we raised the question about your attention and your engagement, and we did seriously contemplate whether it was a form of epilepsy because you seemed to be absent, and that was never sort of thoroughly investigated. But what was clear was you weren't joining in, you weren't participating. And that's significant for anyone any child, because you learn and develop all sorts of social skills, social interaction skills at that early age. Yeah, and I don't necessarily think you can catch up with them. I think they need to be learned at a developmentally appropriate time. So there were differences there. And then there's a lot about mood and behavior once your siblings came along. You had twin siblings. I remember that when we took you to the hospital to see them for the first time, you cried, which I don't think we should read too much into that. Obviously, it's a bit of a shock being in a family of three and suddenly finding you're in a family of five. But as things progressed, another pattern that we noticed is that you were very happy and you could be brilliant company one-to-one. So if we took you out shopping or took you out on an activity, just you, no problem at all, lovely atmosphere. And as soon as you came back into the house, you immediately went and disrupted whatever your twin siblings were doing. And we could almost count down, walk through the door, count down a minute, 2 minutes, and then one of them crying because you'd spoil their game. And there's something, I know that it's probably hard for you to hear, but those were the patterns we were noticing early on in development. So the next sort of critical phase is primary school and what happens in primary school. And what, so I can relate this to you and to our direct experience of you, but I can also relate it to some of the work I was doing when I was in the authority. What I noticed as additional support needs manager, quality improvement officer, was that head teachers would phone me, or principal teacher support, saying they had a difficulty with a child. And sometimes they'd got to crisis point. And this was just what I did. And I would be called into school. And when I look back over the sort of 3 years I was working for the authority, I can guarantee that out of, let's say, 100 cases that I had to deal with, 99 would have been a pupil with undiagnosed autism or undiagnosed ADHD. It fell in, split quite neatly into those two categories rather than anything else. And what seems to happen with youngsters as they go into primary school, when they start off in primary one in Scotland, then a lot of it's play-based, and a child with ADHD doesn't necessarily stand out as being hugely different. They may be a bit more boisterous. They may be have a lower attention, you know, all the things you'd expect, lower attention span and so on. But actually in that environment, it doesn't necessarily come through hugely as a problem. So you read the reports are coming through, and you might just get a little hint about Jimmy needing to calm down a bit at times, not shout out, but generally positive. As you go through those early primary school years, primary two, primary three, then you start getting more negatives coming through, both in terms of what's going on in the classroom, the ability of that child to sit down at the desk and do formal work, and then what's happening in the playground. And it starts off quite low-level concerns being raised about, again, boisterousness. He needs to learn to take his turn, needs to focus and concentrate, etc. And by the time you get to primary four, primary five, then for boys, it's becoming more of an issue. I think for girls, less so, because I think that the presentation of girls may be different, and that they can be less overt hyperactivity and less oppositionality. What happens with, and that you may think that's a good thing, and it, you know, certainly is delaying the onset or the obvious onset of problems. But what happens with girls is that they tend to get into S1 or S2 at secondary school, and then it starts to fall apart. There's something perhaps about the support that their peer group, that girls in primary school may give, which is different to the support that boys in primary school may give to a child who has potentially has ADHD. So with the girls in secondary, once they get to S1, S2, and their problems start to become more conspicuous, that is also the time when a lot of people turn around and say, well, it's the onset of puberty, what do you expect? Rather than looking for the underlying reasons. And what you find there is that the girls become more detached from their peer group. The peer group is developing in a different way, and they suddenly feel that they're not part of that. And they can use certain defense mechanisms in terms of the way they dress, make up, with whom how they identify themselves. And it tends to set them apart. And that's the point at which they can become very lonely. They can display symptoms of anxiety and depression, school refusal, or they could go the other way, which is where they start to really detach, not just from the authority of the school and the supervision network and support network within the school, but also their families. That's when they become very vulnerable, because when you look at a lot of the data for some of the big abuse cases that have arisen over the last few years, what you find is that these girls have detached from what you would call normal family support and normal education support. They're out there in the environment, and they become a target for any predatory males who may be around. So there may be quite different pathways for boys and for girls. In your case, yeah, we had started to have very significant concerns when you're about 7 or 8, to such an extent that we thought, because you were disruptive in school, we thought that in order for the school just to carry on functioning and for the other kids to get an education, we might have to take you out of school. And that I describe as looking into the abyss, because if you come out of school at that point, we didn't see any future for you, to be honest. We thought you were lonely. We thought you were unhappy. We thought you were quite depressed. And we thought you were quite angry. But I don't know whether anyone, including yourself, understood what you were angry about. It certainly, within the family, it changed dynamics within the family, because from your experience, you were saying that I don't understand how everyone can get on with each other so easily, how your siblings manage to negotiate family life so without difficulty, and yet you are having, you know, huge problems yourself. And it just translated, you were very oppositional, you could be very rude, you could spoil a lot of things, but there was no plan. You were a rebel without a cause. There didn't seem to be anything that you were rebelling against. It was just an expression of, an alienation that you didn't understand yourself, you didn't understand what was going on around you particularly, and probably felt resentful about it. So although I wouldn't say there was huge sibling rivalry, I think there was jealousy, but I don't think it was planned. I don't think it was strategically enacted in any way. I just think it was this overall unhappiness that came through.
Going back to girls, I was reading about that maybe a factor. Certainly people think that possibly the development of theirs and boys' brains with respect to ADHD are different, right? That they go along different trajectories. But I was also reading about that possibly the way in which girls and boys socialize in a slightly different way at school is possibly relevant. And that whereas boys don't tend to, certainly in primary school, don't tend to concentrate themselves into smaller groups or dyads, as they called them, whereas girls tended to concentrate themselves in these smaller groups, it exacerbated certain problems that the boys probably didn't have. So if you imagine a boy is running around, he's playing football, he's, you know, whatever, he's just running around from person to person, shouting, getting his energy out. Whereas the girls, if you're operating in these small group structures where communication is really important, and where subtleties of the way you interact socially are much more important, then you might have a much harder time if you've got ADHD, where some of those things are more difficult.
I don't know how much research there is on sort of micro psychology of or micro behavior at that level, at the dyad level. We've got research which demonstrates that children can turn off from a child with ADHD very quickly, within seconds. If they find them too upfront, too in your face, too egocentric in terms of their demands. But whether we can break that down into gender, I'm less sure. Certainly, there is a general feeling the boys with ADHD and girls with ADHD present differently. But I think the differences are more subtle. So you may still get impulsivity and hyperactivity and inattention, because those are the sort of three core parts of ADHD that you need in order to get the diagnosis. But it's how it's not just the way the girl expresses them. It's, as you say, it's what else is going on in the environment. And I would suspect that girls do socialize in subtly different ways, and perhaps sometimes not so subtly. With the boys, if you've got humor, if you've got sporting ability, you can become part of a social group quite easily, as long as you're not too blatantly difficult in your management of relationship. For girls, it tends to be, as you say, in much smaller groupings, more one-to-one, one-to-two, etc. But even then, you find that anecdotally, girls with ADHD find that they can be seem to be part of a small group, but actually they're not. They're much more on the periphery. They're much more following than leading. They're less engaged, and they're just sort of hanging on in there, looking perhaps a bit confused about what's going on. But I don't think we've got enough research to convincingly say that there are huge differences. I would suggest there are differences, but we're not entirely sure how and why they occur.
Was mum emptying the dishwasher there or something?
Yeah, washing machine.
Right, fantastic. Okay. So, well, let's just return to me for a second. So we get to the point where you're staring into the abyss. You've gone out to get some answers from clinicians. I get my diagnosis, and how do things change?
Well, before or around about that time, we were also looking at, there was an organisation in Edinburgh that was looking at the child development, and in particular the differences that occur in terms of, that we associate with neurodevelopmental difficulties and differences in terms of retained reflexes. So ADHD is a neurodevelopmental disorder. It starts at birth, in fact, starts before birth, really. It manifests itself in the early years. And to have a neurodevelopmental disorder, you really need to have some evidence that it's having an impact right in the very, very early years. So when I get involved with a family, one of the questions I will ask is, I'll talk about the sort of normal developmental milestones, walking, crawling, talking. Crawling's an interesting one, because if some children don't crawl, they'll shuffle around on their bottom and then stand up. Some children will crawl, but instead of, they'll crawl homolaterally, so that their left and right go forward at the same time rather than cross laterally. And the thought was that in order to develop cross laterality in the brain, which is what you need for things like handwriting, for reading, for a lot of activities, then you need to develop these neural pathways which cross the midpoint in the brain. And we were looking at that, and we went to have you assessed. And what was very interesting was that they picked out on a lot of retained reflexes, but they also picked up on the fact that your hearing, when they measured it in a very sophisticated way, you weren't hearing everything. And that took us back to when you went to swimming lessons in the where you could also be quite difficult in terms of your behavior. And you stood out when we sat on the balcony looking down. It was very clear that you weren't necessarily conforming all the time. And what we suspect is you weren't hearing instructions. And if we think of a noisy classroom and a noisy gym hall, you weren't discriminating between different frequencies and different voices. So for you, it was probably a fog. You were functioning in a fog and getting into trouble because you weren't following instructions. And the reason you weren't following instructions was because you weren't hearing those instructions. I think there were difficulties. I mean, you're in a very supportive small school and you had friends. Unfortunately, you were able to get outside a lot and do a lot of things where I think you did well, actually. You know, coming to think of it, we tend to think of all the negatives and all the failings, but we also have to accept that you did have friends. I think that the parents of your friends recognized that there were certain differences. They didn't give us a hard time about it, but we gave ourselves a hard time in terms of the fact that, you know, I was working in a school. I had to manage 85, 90 other children and plus do teaching, you know, throughout the school. And you were expected to be able to discipline children and manage their behavior and support their behavior. And here we were struggling with our own child. So we started looking, and I think with a degree of skepticism, into this whole issue of ADHD, but became more and more convinced that there was something going on, partly because you're so different in many respects from your siblings. So eventually we filled out, I think, a Connors rating scale, took it to a clinical psychologist, or I think she was an educational psychologist, who said, yeah, I basically think it's ADHD. And then you got an appointment at Calms, and they really confirmed it. And at that point, I think medication was suggested, but we had quite by chance come across some evidence that certain essential fatty acids or supplements with those could be of benefit. And we tried you on them, and you had this quite remarkable reaction or quite remarkable response. The science at the time said it didn't work, but we tried you, and we didn't tell the primary school, and we just left it to see if there was any evidence, sort of objective observations from them that there were differences. And it came back that, yeah, you were a lot happier. You were a lot more. They put it down to the fact they'd moved your desk, so you're sitting next to someone different. Fair enough. But your relationships improved. You came home. You were a lot happier. And I remember coming home into the house and seeing you and your sibling sitting together on the sofa watching television in a way that we hadn't done before. You were very happy. You were sort of all curled up with each other. Your posture changed. The way you walk changed. You were certainly less depressed, less moody, less oppositional, just because of some official. And you know, I wrote to the company saying, my goodness, what is this stuff? Can I buy shares? Because I was so staggered. I think the science now is suggesting that for certain subgroups within ADHD, there may be a deficiency, and certain brain function may be impaired because of a deficiency in the ability of that young person to metabolize fatty acids from an ordinary diet. So supplementation can help. And certainly since you, I have on maybe half a dozen occasions suggested to parents that they at least try it, because it's not medication, it's just a dietary supplement. The only thing it can harm is your bank balance, because it's not necessarily cheap. But the benefits seem to be in mood and sleep patterns. And you were a responder, which is fantastic, because within days you went from being this quite dysfunctional child to being this very happy child. There's a lot more to it than that. But actually, it relates back to around about this time we were over on the west coast of Scotland, and we had a house there because we had to live in school accommodation. Our own house was on the west coast, and we'd gone across with relatives, and we'd had this awful, awful day with you, just awful, where you were. We actually drove away. We were at some burial mound.
Yeah, I remember it. We climbed up a mountain.
You were just standing.
I was just such a
lifting these stones and
yeah, and I was just being
sort of provocative. I'm going to do what I want, and that you didn't understand what was going on. We didn't understand what was going on, but we did. We literally got you refused to come back into the car. We drove away.
you drove
obviously
with
you
drove
possibly,
away without me. Yeah.
So anyway, day we had mackerel. I think we'd caught our own mackerel, and we had mackerel for tea. The next day, you were absolutely brilliant. We didn't relate these things, and maybe they're not related. But what we said to each other is, I wish we could understand why on one day it can be so difficult and you can yourself be having such problems, and the next day everything could be hunky-dory.
Explain the street science behind why fatty acids might be of benefit to someone with ADHD. Might be of benefit.
A lot of the brain's made up of fat. Fat's important. Fat's important in your diet in order to maintain brain function. And the way that the neurons are built and subsequently function, there is a brain health is important. What I often say if I'm doing training with teachers is, if you walk into Boots and you look down the aisles, you'll find huge amounts of products and services that for your hair, for your feet, for your skin, various other parts of your body. The most important part of your body is your brain. What is there for your brain? Because we don't really understand hugely how the brain functions or how to maintain brain health, then we probably neglect it. The science would suggest that some children respond well to a supplement which helps them maintain a level of brain health that and perhaps an ordinary diet can't, for whatever reason. And with you, it seemed to make sense that you were a lot happier, you were a lot more alert. Your relationships improved, your posture improved, your sleep pattern improved, everything improved. And we didn't know why, other than the fact that we had tried you on these dietary supplements. And so
this is omega-3, right?
Yeah, and when you went on to secondary and you had to move schools and you had to detach from your current social group, which was massive, and I know that you'll probably speak about that at some point, but again, you had started to have difficulties in first year of secondary. To such an extent that we thought, again, that you were going to be excluded from school. So we thought at that point, do we take you back to child and adolescent mental health? Do we get you titrated onto medication? Or should we first increase the amount of fatty acids you're having? So we did. And there was, an immediate improvement. So maybe you'd outgrown, or you had then a higher level of need for supplementation. And looking back, it still might have been the wrong decision. Maybe your outcomes would have been better had you been put on stimulant medication or some other medication that would have more directly treated your ADHD symptoms. We won't know. You can't retrace your steps and go back over.
It's highly likely I would have refused anyway.
Yeah. we said at the time that the fish oil would help you with your football. So you bought into that. I don't know whether it did.
Right. Yeah. Doubtful, because I didn't really kick on in the way I'd hoped as an 11-year-old in the world of professional football, but there we are. Okay, so it's a bit in secondary school what's happening. So I was just getting chucked out of classes, right? I was becoming really difficult with the teachers. Again, very unhappy, right?
One thing that came across was you had this very strong sense of what was fair and what was not fair. And it wasn't always necessarily applying to you. So there's one particular teacher who had difficulty controlling the class. And when we looked back on a series of incidents and why you got into trouble. You weren't initially in trouble at all. It was someone else. But then you stuck your big fat nose in and tried to argue on that other child's, but on your friend's behalf. That's when you got into trouble. So that was one thing that came through. But there was another occasion, I don't know if you remember it, where you were, I think it's supposed to be a swimming lesson. And so the school had a swimming pool. You went to the and lined up. And then the teacher came along and said, have you all got your kit? You said, no, I haven't. So he had to go back to your locker. On your way back to your locker, someone stopped you and said, where's that punishment exercise that you should have given me? And the whole thing just escalated into, and you, part of the issue was, one of the features that comes through with you is you have a very poor awareness of time. So most of us have an internal clock. If we said 10 minutes, we would have an understanding that if the family's going out in 10 minutes, what that 10 minutes was. Most of us have a degree of a level of working memory, short and medium term memory, where we know we need to do certain things. You didn't. And that got you into lots of trouble because relating back to that incident where you had to leave the queue, go back to your locker to find your kit. Your kit was never there. Your kit was at your feet all the time and you hadn't noticed it. So it became a big incident over something that was nothing. And a lot of it to do with forgetfulness, personal organization, very poor time management, horribly poor time management. And all of those conspired to make secondary school extremely challenging for you and for your teachers.
I mean, I'm definitely ready to take responsibility for a lot of that. In as much as you can take responsibility as someone who is struggling, but I do think that there were teachers who maybe there aren't quite as many of them nowadays, but there were definitely teachers for whom the idea of ADHD was not something they were willing to
correct.
To give time to. There were teachers that definitely just thought I was a nasty kid, or and who weren't willing to accommodate. I mean, I don't know if it sounds really entitled saying they should have accommodated, but I think little things like, I think had some of them had a greater awareness, for instance, that giving me complex verbal instructions. Mm-hmm. And expecting me to act them out and not forget one of the things they said, and then to become confrontational with me when I forgot to do one of the things that they'd said verbally. I mean, that's something that I wouldn't recommend to a teacher dealing with a child with ADHD.
Absolutely not. And having worked as principal teacher of support in a secondary and been into a lot of classes across the whole school, so the whole range from modern languages to RE, English, math, science, etc. What came through for me watching other teachers teach is those sort of common, I suppose we call them errors, but I think it's about good teaching that you'd find, for example, I remember science lessons where you'd go into the lab and the equipment wouldn't be there. So the first 5-10 minutes is spent faffing around, sending kids off to other parts of the department to bring the apparatus that's needed. Then 10 minutes on talking about what was done in the previous lesson. Then 10-15 minutes of instructions leading on to what they were going to do this lesson, how they had to set up their equipment. This is what they were going to be looking at. And all of this was done verbally. And the child with ADHD whose attention span is short, and for lots of kids, whether they've got ADHD or not, or kids of that age, their attention spans are quite short. Everything is delivered verbally. And they lose, you lose kids within minutes. They haven't got a clue. And you see it. What happens when the teacher says, right, get on with it? You just see these blank faces and someone asking their neighbour, what do we do now? Where do we go now? What's all this about? The simple technique is to have your whiteboard and to write the instructions on the whiteboard and not to put all the instructions necessarily up at once. So, right, step one, this is all I want you to do. And I remember one of the... And he's quite an experienced teacher and head of department saying to me, I'm just having terrible problems with the behaviour of my S1 class. Give me some clues as to what I could do. And what I said was, one thing to try is to cut out all of this stuff at the beginning of the lesson. Make sure the equipment is there right at the very beginning. That's critical. Have quite a sharp start to the lesson. Welcome the kids. Stand at the door, welcome the kids in. It's all about relationships. And it's all about the sense of there's a very clear structure and organization to the lesson. But then, instead of all this verbal stuff, instead of all this talk, just divide them into groups, give each group an envelope, and on the envelope are the instructions. Let them open the envelope, let them see the instruction, and then just expect them to do it. And he did it. I wasn't there for the lesson, but he said it transformed that particular lesson. See, a lot of it is to do with basic teaching. That if you have someone who teaches the subject, who stands at the front and just expects kids to get on with it, they're not going to be particularly successful anyway. Forget whether the pupils have ADHD or not. If you're teaching to the child and it's about your relationship with the child, it's very different. So you got on really well with, I think, two types of teacher. One was the teacher who liked you, who wanted to have a decent relationship with you. The other type of teacher, quite perversely, were some of the dinosaur teachers who were actually very strict. They're quite frightening, who would probably say that ADHD doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But that structure, I suppose there was an element of fear about it. That could also work. Now, not all teachers can do that. A lot of it's just down to personality. But where you were in, and I think I was the same. If I think back to when I was at secondary school, two teachers who turned my maths and my biology round from despair to actually being quite successful were teachers who wouldn't give two hoots for ADHD. They were just very strict, very structured. You knew exactly where you stood with them. And yeah, it worked for me.
I sometimes worry because I've got friends who are teachers, and I see sometimes some of the materials that they get, that they you know, they have to read from the curriculum or whatever, and there's a huge amount about child-led stuff, child-led learning and all this sort of stuff. And now I can completely understand why that's the case and why that is an important component of a curriculum. My worry is kind of exactly what you said, that actually I think for some kids something being child-led could actually be quite counterproductive, and actually some kids don't want it to be child-led and want it to be, well, it can be child-led in terms of accommodating their particular sensory profiles and their particular needs and that sort of thing. But I think for some kids, we both worked at a special school, and actually for some of the kids, some of the most like ADHD unmanageable kids, the lessons where they performed the best were things like maths, where they went into a classroom and they were just given a sheet of sums to do, and the teacher was very old school.
Yeah, and it's just about balance, because you do want some learning to be child-led. You want children to develop curiosity in the world around them and to generate their own questions, and then to develop the skills and their own resources, intellectual resources, to be able to answer those questions. That I think, underlines a lot of the curriculum for excellence, and I think it's a really good thing. But there also needs to be some, but you can't have the whole of the school day like that. You can't have them going into a maths. Well, you can to a certain degree, but I think that you're quite right that structure is needed. And I found that myself, you know, long before I got involved with additional support needs, and I was a geography teacher, I would sometimes get bored, you know, because I've got ADHD probably. And I was sometimes the most disruptive person in the classroom because I got bored.
Right, okay.
Well, I obviously like the process of teaching and engaging with kids and walking around the classroom. And, you know, that's in terms of basic teaching techniques, the teacher who stands at the front of the class for the whole lesson is probably in a hiding to nothing with the kids who've got ADHD who are sitting at the back and are disengaging. So it was always, I was always walking around the classroom. I was always sort of putting my hand on a child's desk because it raises their alert levels. I might pick up their book and wave it around the room to show people. It's all about keeping the attention span going, keeping the engagement, the involvement going. So if there were times when I might set a question to do, you know, like a practice exam question, the sort of room would go quiet and they'd be getting on with it, and I'd get bored. So I would then find an excuse to, and I shouldn't, you know, it was bad teaching. But when I tried to break up my teaching pattern, and I would try this with, let's say, 14, 15-year-olds, where I got them working in groups, or I got them setting their own questions, a lot of the girls didn't like that. Or those kids who really just wanted to turn up to class, be taught something, walk away from class, have it in the jotter or the notes. They didn't like the less structured, or what appeared to be a less structured approach, whereas some in the class did. And it is about balance. I think you're quite right. And I think it's about balance for a group of kids as a whole. But I think it's also about the individual, for each individual. If it was highly structured throughout the school day, that's not necessarily the best thing. If it's relatively unstructured throughout the whole school day, that's not going to work.
it's juggling, getting the balance right. And that for a head teacher of a school, that's balancing personalities, balancing teachers, balancing the curriculum, balancing the diet that they are of learning that they're receiving throughout the school day. And it poses, you never get it right, 100% of the time. But at least I think in the places that I worked, we were continually thinking about it.
Can we wrap it up in 5 minutes? But first of all, talk about jump back to me at secondary school and then up until university, really. So when stuff starts to be going slightly better, yeah, can you talk about that from your perspective as a parent?
Yeah. So this is supposed to be about you, but in a sense, it's also about me, because I was I was always at the bottom of the class. And I think there were four classes in each year. So out of 120 kids, I would be sort of like 110th in terms of my performance. And it was a fog. Everything that was going, I didn't know I was there. I didn't, conjugating French, but what's all that about? Science, didn't have a clue. Certain subjects interested me, like aspects of English and geography. But I really hated it. I hated it a lot. And when I got to the age of about 14, 15, and you're starting to do, I had a careers test. And the outcome of the careers test was that I should leave at 16 and go and work in the hotel trade, something similar, because I wasn't engaging in learning at all. And I managed to scrape through the exams I needed. And we needed to get 4 O-levels to go into sixth form. And it looked pretty precarious at one point. But I got 7, not particularly spectacular. But then there was a transformation. And I remember one teacher saying to me, I thought I'd done really well to get 7 when I was at risk of not getting 4. And the tutor said to me, he was glad that I was in his tutor group for what we call fifth year. And those exam, you could have done a lot better, which could have gone 2 ways. One, it could have really put me off, but actually it quite inspired me. But the significant thing was I was now doing subjects that I wanted to do. So I was doing politics and geography and English. It really harnessed a certain set of skills that weren't exploited before that, because before that it was all about learning and almost rote learning. And this was much more about synthesizing information and looking at a book, looking at themes within a book, looking at politics and what was going on in the world. And suddenly I went from being right at the bottom to right at the top. I started, when exams came along, I came top in exams. When after those 2 years, I got some of the best A-level results in the school. In fact, I got an award from the local authority. So something odd happened. And I think it happened with you as well, in that you could ditch the stuff that really was... what saddened me was that you didn't take art further, because I think you had certain abilities with art. But you were doing subjects like English and geography, which worked for you. And where it wasn't just the subject matter, but it was also the teachers... you were engaging with. And I think there is, we don't necessarily fully understand the impact of reducing the curriculum, developing islands of competence, developing natural interests and skills. With you, it worked, and you were able to go on. You from being sort of a demon within the school, you became a head of house. And that said something about your underlying qualities that the in terms of the peer group, because I think they had to vote for you and they liked you. I think it's partly because you were quite disruptive and comical. You had a sense of humour, and they respected that. And you got elected to be head of house, and then you managed to get decent results and go on to university. So it does get you thinking about whether when kids are failing in school, it's they that are failing rather than the school, where in terms of the learning and teaching, and critically in terms of relationships. I always say to teachers, those kids who are noisy and disruptive, the class clown, but in the way that you were, think of them, yes, that they are making your job a lot more difficult, but those kids are also in trouble. You need to look at those kids. You need to develop relationships with them. You need to keep them involved in education, because for a lot of kids with ADHD who disengage from education at 14, 15, 16, their outcomes are horrible. And it's something in terms of criminal justice system, pathways through to substance use, breakdown of families, et cetera, and then unemployment later on in life. And again, one of the we talked the other day about adult expression of ADHD coming through as anxiety and depression. And the other one that we didn't mention as part of that is social isolation. Because those kids who look as if they've got loads and loads of friends, who are the class clown, very disruptive at 13, 14, by the time they're 20, 21, they're sitting at home. They don't have friends. They're not going out. having quite miserable lives. So understanding that pathway is very helpful in terms for a teacher of thinking, conceptualizing what they've got in front of them. One head teacher, after a session I did, said, "What you've said gives us permission to like the unlikable child, or a way of liking the apparently unlikable child." And that's how I see it. It's always about sort of an unconditionality in terms of the relationship that you, it may have been hell one day, but you still greet that young person coming into your classroom in a friendly and positive manner, rather than saying, "I hope you're going to be better behaved today than you were yesterday," and thus dragging up that whole legacy of negativity that actually you should be ditching and moving on.
What about this idea? Because it's kind of a bit of an ideological battleground between people that are very genetics focused, but then you've got others who really downplay it and view behavior very much as being caused by the environment, and are very skeptical of things, conditions that you medicate, and all sorts of things like that.
I'm fully aware that there is a great deal of skepticism towards what they call the medical model, and the idea that it's all down to the biology and the physiology of the brain and the genetics and whatever. And actually, when you speak to people who are working in the field of neurodevelopment, they never say that. They never, ever say it's all genetics or it's all due to brain development. What the consensus is at the moment is that it's, to understand any individual or to understand a population, you need to look at epigenetics. You need to look at the combination or a very complex choreography between the genetic expression within an individual and how that's played out within the environment. And it's a two-way process, and it's a dynamic process. So you could get two hypothetical children with exactly the same genetic profile, put them in different families, and they will turn out different, which is why ADHD is so complex, because all families are different. And it's understanding how those processes occur and how any intervention or treatment or support can be put in place to alleviate them. And what the overriding, again, consensus is at the moment is that when you look at ADHD, which is often conceived as a behavioral problem, in fact, it's labeled as a behavioral problem. When you speak to young people with ADHD, the one thing that they say that they really want to change about their lives is friendships. And it's more about friendships and relationships than whether it's relationships with the peer group, which is clearly going to be incredibly important, or their parents or teachers. That's what they want to change. And they won't necessarily say so to a clinician. They will say they're doing fine and they've got lots of friends, but actually they're very lonely. A lot of them are very, very lonely. And they feel like you described when you talked about your siblings, they feel quite cut off and different from the people around them. So I would urge anyone who's looking at ADHD or any other child development issue to consider that epigenetics is the framework in which we can bring together those what appear to be conflicting arguments about nature and nurture. Those are terms we should not be using. We know that the environment trumps genes virtually every time, but it's how the environment affects genetic expression that's the important thing. And the important thing about that is it gives us a way of understanding the best ways of working with young people who have ADHD to get positive outcomes rather than negative outcomes. And it doesn't rely on medication. And there has been a huge emphasis on medication because it works. You know, the treatment to a large degree works, at least in the short term. But what we know is it's insufficient. So it's effective.
Well, clarify those comments, right? Because we need to be careful with medication. So you say it works. It doesn't work for everyone, right? And different medications don't work for everyone. Talk a little bit, because there might be people watching or listening who haven't gone through the diagnostic process yet, maybe don't have an understanding of, you know, have a quite understandable fear of what stimulant medication actually is. We can't maybe talk, we should maybe leave that to the CAMS or whatever, but what about the process of titration and this sort of thing?
I think there are a huge number of issues. And let's face it, neither of us are medical professionals, so we've got to be very careful. But I think that there's certain key principles that need to be established. First of all, not all medication is stimulant medication. Sorry, not all medication and treatment for ADHD is stimulant. doesn't all simulate the central nervous system. Some works in different ways. There are different types of treatment now available, whereas there weren't in the past. We've got to be very careful about coming with a set of values that is informed by the mass media, by programs we've seen, by research that comes from, let's say, North America, because we're talking about two completely different medical systems, two completely different cultures. And in North America, the data suggests that between 7, 8, 9% of kids have been diagnosed and medicated for ADHD. In this country, it's about 1%. So we're in a completely different world. And the way that the health systems are set up, in America, if you have health insurance, then you can go along and you can effectively demand an assessment for ADHD, demand the medication, even if it isn't entirely necessary. You can demand it and say that you're entitled to it. In this country, it's completely different. And we're extremely conservative, and that's reassuring to some degree, that child psychiatrists don't throw out medication to every problem that comes towards them. They are extremely careful about it. And that probably means that we're under-recognizing and under-treating quite a large number of children. And those children, young people, are not just walking around without the label ADHD attached to them, but they're also probably having very, very poor outcomes. They're excluded from school. They're in the Young Offenders Institution, in contact with the criminal justice system. They could have secondary mental health problems that have been associated with ADHD. So it's not a minor thing to say a child is underdiagnosed, the children underdiagnosed and untreated. It's very carefully worked out by the epidemiologists and others. So in this country, we're at the bottom of a curve, and it's inevitable that the recognition and the diagnosis and assessment and therefore the treatment of ADHD will increase. And that causes huge issues for politicians because they don't like to see the rate of medication going up because they think it's in some way sort of indication of a failing in the system, whereas in fact it's probably more a signal of a success in the system. The other set of issues around medication are that if you were to ask the average American child why you're on medication for ADHD, they will say it's to improve my performance at school. If you ask the majority of British kids, who are admittedly probably at the more severe end, they will say it's to control my behavior. And that throws up some interesting issues around the politics of giving medication to children, because I would suggest that a lot of children in Britain don't understand what the medication is for or why it's being given. They think it's adults trying to control them rather than help them, or they themselves having some sort of investment in helping themselves. And that raises a lot of issues when they get to their teenage years, at a point where the environmental risks are increasing, that a lot of kids, as part of adolescence, want to come off their medication because they want to reinforce their own identity or define their own identity. And the medication is part of something that's been imposed by adults, therefore get rid of it. But that's the time when, as I say, the risks are quite high. And the other piece of research that's relevant to all of that is that although children should always have a voice in any treatment that's taking place, it should be an informed voice. And what we know about kids with ADHD is that they're pretty poor assessing their own performance in terms of social relationships. So they will say they're doing very well, they've got lots of friends. Actually, they haven't. And it's about the quality of friendships rather than the number of people that they've got on Facebook or on the phone, you know, in contacts on the phone. It needs quite skilled assessment to make sense of that.
Why are they poor at assessing their own kind of performance socially or at home or academically?
I don't know whether there's a single reason for that. It can be partly due to maturity, that we become more self-aware as we get older, and it may be linked in with the development of empathy, because if we develop empathy and an understanding in others, that I would suggest is in tandem associated with an understanding of self. So as you become more conscious of others, so you become more conscious of yourself and the impact you have on others. With kids with ADHD, when they're about 12, 13, they are 2 to 3 years in terms of various aspects of brain development, 2 to 3 years behind their peers. So they're quite immature in some respects. And it may be that lack of maturity, lack of self-awareness, that, or the stigma and the, you know, the embarrassment of actually saying, I'm not getting on with everyone else in my class. I do feel that I'm too brash, I'm too impulsive, I say things and then regret saying them. And what happens with a lot of young people with ADHD is by the time they get to 12, 13, 14, they start actively disassociating from their peers or choosing different choosing the wrong peer groups. They, you know, gang membership, studies of gang membership in London and Brazil. The favelas of Brazil have shown a disproportionate number of kids in those gangs have meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. And when you start to tease apart the layers, the causation behind that, you look at the fact that within a gang, you have a clear identity, you have a clear structure, there's a sense of progression. The very things that were getting you into trouble in the past actually give you kudos. So whether it's stealing, whether it's being disruptive, whatever, you get identity from that. And if we want to understand why kids go off the rails at that particular point, a lot of it's to do with where they feel they belong. In other words, joining a gang gives them what they're not getting in the non-gang world, you know, in the outside world. It's giving them the sense of identity. It's giving them connections. It's giving them the sense that they are of value, which is massively important. And if the tasks that are set or the whatever you perform in a gang means that you succeed, if you're not succeeding in school, if you're not succeeding at home, then it's almost rational and logical and natural to want to be part of something that is going to fulfill you in some way.
So that's on a psychological level. Possibly in terms of neurochemistry, though, there's probably an element of thrill seeking or the reward centers of the brain. That probably plays a factor, right, in pursuing dangerous behaviors and dangerous being around more exciting / dangerous people, right? Is it not possible that for some kids with ADHD, well, for some teenagers, let's say, with ADHD, that just hanging out is actually not going to particularly give them a great deal, or just doing well at school isn't going to particularly give them a great deal of satisfaction or sense of, it's not going to feed their brain in the same way as thrill seeking is, right?
There's a lot, yeah, and I think it goes beyond ADHD, that the idea of the way dopamine works in the brain, the reward systems in the brain, that we know that kids with hyperactivity don't have a stop mechanism. Or sorry, they have a poorer stop mechanism. That they need feedback quite often, quite quickly. So if you're a boring teacher, if you stand at the front and lecture a class, or if you set tasks which take days or weeks and the kids don't get feedback from them, or if there's no recognition of the work that's been put in, perhaps during the course of a lesson, then you turn off quite quickly. And that should inform the way we teach. It should inform, and again, it goes beyond ADHD. I think for a lot of kids, they need quite a lot of feedback. They need encouragement. They need to understand that they're actually making progress. They need to understand the relevance of what they're doing. And I don't think we're particularly good at that. In a lot of educational settings, I don't think we spend enough time thinking about the actual teaching process and how relationships and feedback is so important to that. But in other respects, then, yeah, you know, you're right, that the thrill-seeking, the adrenaline rush, the dopamine hit that you get from stealing a car, from, you know, it starts off by knocking on people's doors and running away, and that sort of thing, that is actually quite powerful. And of course, what happens later in the teenage years is because if that can't be satisfied, then you find other ways of controlling those urges. You can do either more dangerous things, or you can look for something in the environment that suppresses that urge. And that's very often self-medication. That's why the two most commonly used drugs to treat ADHD are nicotine and alcohol, or nicotine, alcohol, and cannabis, because the majority of people with ADHD in the world self-medicate. They'll self-medicate using those particular drugs. I think there is a huge drive, and it has been for the last 15 years, to find safe ways of addressing the sort of processing deficits that are associated with ADHD. And so delivery systems, for example, of methylphenidate that are a slow release, so you don't get big spikes and then coming down, big spike. And the reason why the money's going into that research rather than anything else is because there is a profit motive. The pharmaceutical companies see an opportunity
they are willing to invest the tens of millions of dollars that's necessary to bring a drug to market. And there's no one in other fields who's willing to spend the same amount of money doing the research on non-pharmacological interventions. So that's why we've got this big divide between pharmacology and non-pharmacology. It's largely to do with funding and research, and also the complexities of the research, because there are so many confounding factors whenever you do long-term research. When you start looking at undiagnosed adults with ADHD who are looking for assessment, one of the patterns that comes through really clearly is substance use, smoking and alcohol in particular. But you'll also find when you can ask someone about whether what drugs do they use, cannabis is very common for obvious reasons. If they say that they've used cocaine and you ask them, well, what effect did that have on you? Whereas the majority of people without ADHD will say it made them really alive and alert and active and everything else. When you speak to someone with ADHD, they say, well, I just wanted to go home and tidy my room. I just wanted to go home and do my finances or write that essay, dissertation. Because they suddenly have a level of clarity that they haven't had before, and they want to make use of it. But the issue, of course, is that when you look at the very strong association between ADHD and offending, because something like a quarter of all young people in young offenders institutions meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. But when you look at the pathway, it's not the ADHD causing. We might think of it as you've got ADHD, you go into a supermarket, you see something you want, you can't afford it, you nick it, and you get caught. Because kids with ADHD are not very good at planning, and they're not very good at thinking ahead and escaping. But actually, it's much more than that, that the association between ADHD and offending is through substance use. That once kids who are not being treated, where they're not understanding their own ADHD, their family's not understanding it, the school system isn't understanding it, if they start using substances, then it leads them either directly or indirectly through their association with other individuals down a pathway that ends up in some the criminal justice system and some young offenders institution. It's an indirect rather than a direct route. Just because you've got ADHD doesn't mean you're going to be an offender. But two critical things, stay in the school system and the structure of the school system, and the other is don't use or be very careful about your use of substances.
Well, Ritter, can we just maybe jump back to your experiences as a parent? Because I think that probably some of this stuff is really helpful, but I think probably people are also quite interested to just hear from another parent, and particularly one who's, informed and whatever. But maybe just describing sort of from the sidelines as a parent, what it was like seeing me grow up and struggle, and maybe some notable moments, perhaps, just kind of through the ages, might resonate with some people.
What I think, the way the popular press often portrays ADHD is it coming from lower socioeconomic groups. It's really to do with poor parenting. We need to teach these parents how to parent properly, and then we wouldn't have ADHD. When you've been through it yourself, what you realize is it's much more complex than that. And if you're in the position where you've got a child who's not developing in the way that you think they should, and that's causing them difficulties as well as the family, there is a tendency to attribute blame to yourself. And the advantage of having a diagnosis is it takes a lot of pressure off. It means that rather than husband and wife arguing over the best approach, you get a unified approach and you get a consistency. And you also get an informed approach to what's going to work. You also become aware of the risks of getting it wrong. And you realize that actually you're the only people there who are going to support your son or daughter through this, what is going to be probably quite a difficult adolescence and even early adulthood. So you start taking the longer view rather than just trying to correct everything that's gone wrong, every misdemeanor. You start to weigh up. And I think one of the key things is to weigh up the diet that you're feeding a child, the emotional diet. Because if you look at some of the studies, there's one particular study I recall, which was done by a lady called Julia Ruckledge in New Zealand, where she looked at adults and did the childhood trauma questionnaire with them. And the results were quite striking, because the non-ADHD group, some of them had very difficult childhoods and upbringings, but the ADHD group were massively more negative in terms of whether they felt loved, whether they felt protected, whether they, some the higher indications of abuse, for example,
whether people looked after them, whether people called them names. And you suddenly realize, if you do an audit for a child with ADHD, let's think of the school system. It's something I try to get across to teachers, is that you're struggling with Jimmy, who's 13 and he's not doing well in school, and he's causing you difficulties because he's disrupting the class and he doesn't seem to show any respect, et cetera, et cetera. But understand that the most positive experience of the day might be school for him. And we can be feeding so many negatives to a child because they're not performing well in school, but they're also getting, they may also be getting that at home. So what impact is going to be that diet of negativity on the development of that child in terms of their self-esteem, their self-belief, their understanding of others? And it encourages to think much more positively, I would suggest, about identifying islands of competence in young people, in being forgiving, in choosing the battles that you fight, in ensuring that amongst all the negatives that we're throwing at young people, we are throwing the positives as well. And I don't think it's in our culture necessarily to sit down with a kid and say, we really value you, you know, we really like you. You may have had a rough time today at home, or you may have had a rough time at school, but just bear in mind, we're in it for the long run. And so are you. And we will always be there. Really important message to get across. Because kids get this sense of rejection. They're self-rejecting. They are rejecting themselves as well as being rejected.
Can you clarify what you mean by islands of competence? Don't know if that's a term some people will be familiar with.
It's about chasing the positives. And it's about finding something to build on. So what you can find in school settings is that if you're struggling with the youngster who isn't really conforming to the system, isn't getting on well, isn't responding to all the other sanctions and structures that you put in place, what schools will often do is, if a child does something wrong, they will say, well, he can't go to football training on a Thursday because that's something he likes, so we'll take it away from him. And it's quite perverse in a way. And you can understand why they're doing it, because they're trying to find some mechanism to change behavior. But what they're doing is taking away the one thing that young person is good at, the one thing which you can build. So when I ran special schools, right, a special school, I made a point of protecting when I say protect, I don't mean stopping other staff from sort of imposing sanctions or whatever, but in my own brain saying, don't do it. You might have some leverage. It might be one way of getting a message across to that young person. But actually, a much more important message to get across to that young person is a sense that they can succeed. You've got to just turn it around in some way and say that, okay, so that Jimmy has done something dreadfully wrong, he's still going to football on Thursday night. He's still got to do that because it's important to him. And it's very... I'm not saying I would never take that away and never use it as a sanction, but I would be incredibly careful about doing it.
It's difficult because, yeah, I worked at a special school as well. And, you know, there was a kid I supported and, you know, fantastic kid. But I did that a couple of times, right? I was their key member of staff and they were just, you know, they did some bad stuff. And it was the only thing I could really think of, you know, to...
I know the circumstances that you're talking about, and we actually discussed that at the time, and I agreed when you took that decision, it was a sensible, rational decision.
Yeah. It's tough, though, isn't it? Because it's so hard to see a kid who's struggling in so many other ways, yep. And really to take that one thing that they like doing away is just...
But there's also balance, because if I remember the occasion particularly well, which I think I do, and I think this was part of our... thinking at the time, it was that the impact of that young person on others was so profound, yeah. That for their sake, it was important that he, on those couple of occasions, didn't attend football training. So, but as a general point, what you want to try to do is to develop strengths in young people and not take them away. I think it's incredibly important.
What I get a lot of is when it comes out that I have a diagnosis of ADHD, often people look at me kind of strange and they're like, well, you know, could have fooled me. That's very strange because I come across as quite placid and whatever now. and maybe a bit more considered and everything. Can you maybe explain to someone, why can you see such profound changes in people with ADHD through their, you know, the first quarter of their lives or the first half of their lives as they're developing?
Because it's a very complex disorder, you're going to get different young people develop in different ways because they're individuals. They may have a diagnosis of ADHD, but they're also individuals. They also have different experiences of family and environmental factors that are influencing. So, but there are certain common denominators or certain patterns that we would see. And there are also different presentations of ADHD. So you can get the very hyperactive child. And some kids, you can actually tell a child might be or is at risk of ADHD very early in life because they are noticeably hyperactive at 2, 3, 4 years old. You wouldn't treat and be very, very cautious about any sort of treatment before 6 anyway, because that's what the guidelines suggest. But the hyperactivity in those children can change from running around. You can get micro hyperactivity, which is a lot of toe tapping, face tap, you know, finger movements and whatever, which sometimes are not so noticeable in school settings. And it's why teachers say they're not hyperactive when in fact they are, but it's just very subtle. And that hyperactivity it's still there, but it changes throughout the lifespan. So it becomes less about sort of physical movement and more about relationships, jobs, not being able to sustain anything for a period of time and so on. But the other patterns that come through loud and clear for me through my work with adults is that, substance use is really, really, really common. Relationship difficulties, job difficulties are very, very common. But the things that stand out are anxiety and depression. And of course, we know that the prevalence rate for both of those is quite high in the general population. So a lot of people with ADHD in adulthood will go to a doctor, say they're having difficulties, and in a 10-minute consultation, anxiety and depression are diagnosed, but not necessarily what's led up to that. And that's why our rate of diagnosis in adults are so low. And it's also the fact that a lot of GPs are not trained or they don't have the diagnostic tools. A lot of adult psychiatrists have quite low levels of training in recognizing ADHD, and they don't necessarily have the time to really delve into some depth. But when I meet someone, and it happens quite often, someone who's 24, 25 comes to me and says, someone told me I might have ADHD. You can often find very distinct patterns in childhood. You always go back to childhood because it's really critical that there's onset of symptoms before, I think it's 12 now. And evidence from school records, from parental report and so on, indicates that this youngster had quite a high level of difficulty throughout, but often not necessarily the level where they are always being expelled from school or immediately in contact with the criminal justice system. It can be much more subtle than that. And you've got to really pull that together. But there are very strong common patterns. And the one that is almost universal is anxiety and depression. That it's a dual combination. With a condition or a disorder like autism, then what you're looking for very often is quite distinct and unusual behaviors or processing or understanding and communication. So something that's different. But, so with autism, it might be that the way a child interacts with other children, that it might be about collecting objects or the way they played as an individual without demonstrating imaginative behaviors. With ADHD, it's different because all of the main diagnostic features are not normal. You would get in a normal population. So some kids are impulsive, some kids can be hyperactive at times. It's more the degree of those, what we might call normal dimensions of behavior, that indicate that whether a child has ADHD or not, and the combination of those, and the fact that they're sustained over a period of time, and the fact they occur in different settings. So that's where you have to go with ADHD. And I think that's why the public and the press can find it very difficult to conceptualize, because they see in those terms as just normal. And that with a bit of discipline, these kids would not have effectively ADHD symptoms. And of course, we know that that's not true. The research tells us that's not true. But that's one of the real dilemmas in diagnostics is you're not dealing with something that with a blood, you can't do a blood test. There's no particular gene, as in Down syndrome. You can't say it's a specific chromosome or whatever that's different. It's a set of behaviors and pattern of behaviors that is consistently demonstrated over a period of time in different settings, and is at the extreme end of what we might call normal.
that's what makes it such a contentious disorder to diagnose and treat.
On that provocative note, we will call it a day. Go and enjoy your dinner, and I'll give you a call tomorrow.
Okay.